You're listening to The Opioid Matrix, a journey into the rabbit hole, a Rugaku podcast hosted by Michael Brown. This is an unfiltered conversation that examines how illicit narcotic trafficking is affecting every aspect of our society, including substance addiction, treatment programs, and law enforcement. Let's unpack the issue together.
Welcome to The Opioid Matrix podcast. I'm your host, Michael Brown. On today's episode, we're going to shine a light onto a topic that's close to home for many, drug addiction and how it can pass from one generation to the next. Have you ever wondered why addiction seems to run in some families? The reality is, when a parent struggles with substance abuse, their children can find themselves at a much higher risk of facing the same battle. This generational cycle of addiction is fueled by a mix of genetics, family environment, and even lingering trauma. Today, we're digging into why this pattern happens, what's at stake for families, and most importantly, what it takes to finally break the cycle for good. The phenomena where children of substance abusing parents are more likely to become substance users themselves is commonly referred to as the intergenerational transmission of substance use addiction. My guest today, Chris Schultz, knows firsthand the experience of being a young teen who inherited substance use transmission and drug trafficking from his family. But this story, unlike many, is a success story in progress because Chris is now years in recovery. He owns his own electrical company. He's active in the ministry and closely works with those struggling with addiction. Chris, I want to welcome you to the Matrix.
Thank you, Michael, very much. What an intro. Man, I can't compete with that. That was beautiful, man. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I definitely appreciate you coming out to tell your story. Your story of what I call pure survival, starting at the age of 13, is one that many teens, simply never recover from. Now, as we find in Ephesians 5:8, you seem to have embraced the transformation from moving from the dark to a new state of light and well-being. Can you just give our audience a little background how at the age of 13, you became entrenched in this generational drug use addiction and just some aspect of drug trafficking, from what I understand?
Absolutely, Michael. So grew up younger age with a white picket fence, all-American family. Father ends up picking up and using. I was probably around 8 to 10 years old. Got so in depth with the methamphetamine, marijuana, pills, pretty much anything he could really get his hand on. And witnessing this behavior, just not with my dad, but my aunts, uncles, family members, and this became of the norm. There was many times and, you know, we would have family gatherings, Christmases, lots of alcohol, pots, everybody would be high. And it seemed, you know, it became more of the norm. At the age of 12 years old, my dad had an affair on my mom. And at that time, my mom left him and a divorce occurred. You know, I went from middle school having good grades and 3.0 grade average, 3.5, just excelled in sports, BMX, motocross. And it felt like my little world now was being ripped apart. Shifting through, you know, I held a lot of resentment towards my mom and because, you know, my mom pushed for the divorce. So what I ended up doing was seeking to go live with my dad. Not the best place. My dad was not in a good place. He was dealing with his shame, his guilt, all of the addiction issues that he was going through. And at that time, my dad wanted to be my friend. And so picking up and using with me, he thought that was the way to go. And, you know, Michael, my dad is no longer around. I made that amends with him before he did pass. And my dad passed, unfortunately, of alcoholism. He continued to use drugs and, you know, drink until he died. And one of the things for myself growing up, I never did drugs, smoked weed, anything with all of my kids. And I have 8 kids by the grace of God, you know. And one of the biggest things I learned how that affected my life. Because here, Michael, I'm looking up to my dad as my hero. That is the guy who's led me. If dad's doing it, it should be okay. Dad works, provides, has a car. He's cool, got the good lingo, plays the crazy music. And if he's doing it, that must be okay. And so we look at it from my lens as a child. It seemed to be okay. And we know, Michael, that's not right. And this generational sin happens just not in our family, but many families as well. And this is the norm, unfortunately, that we see in the society that we serve at church or even with Rotary clubs, that we're seeing more and more families that they accept this type of behavior.
You know, your story is very interesting. You know, when I was at DEI, I worked in Detroit for many years in the inner cities, communities of brown and black people. And this was a very common phenomenon. We see a lot of young men get into drug trafficking. They get arrested. I talked to them. I said, you know, how did you get into this at the age of 16 and 17? He said, well, my dad was a drug trafficker. His dad was a drug trafficker.
Yeah.
My parents divorced or they were never married. And I never had a positive role model. So I looked up to my father and I wanted to emulate him. So he was a drug trafficker. He was cool. He did drugs. He drank. So I drank. But it's interesting to see your story because you had the white picket fence. You had the upbringing, a mother and a father, and you still fell victim to that generational transmission of negative drug use behavior. And it's just very interesting because so many teens don't make it out. So, I mean, you had a whole family of influence, aunts, uncles, drinking at holiday parties. How did you manage to get out of that and not just become another statistic?
Absolutely. You know, Michael, shifting gears, let's get into 15 years old. I was driving a car, didn't even have a driver's license, literally driving a car. My aunt and her ex, big suppliers out of Fontana, biker clubs. Here I'm, little 15-year-old guy, sweaty palms, white knuckling this wheel, you know, and taking her down there to go score her dope. And all these, you know, she was breaking me off. I thought I was the coolest thing since sliced bread. But you know what? I was contributing into so many dysfunctional behaviors. I was indulging into it. I was feeding the flesh, my own desire, not knowing what I was getting myself into. And before you know it, Michael, it just continuing to escalate. Then violence came in, bad people, criminal mentality, and the people in the intersections that I came across were just like, and as a younger kid, you know, my brain is not fully grown. The front cortex of it all, you know, I have all the ability of thinking correctly and exposed to all this. It was more of a flight or flight stage of my life, you know, and just trying to survive in a sense, you know, multiple car accidents, almost being stabbed. And this is all in the teenage years of my life. And, you know, personally, I am currently working with EMDR. EMDR it's therapy with they use the eyes, eye rapid motion. I don't know the acronym, so please forgive me. But I go in for 3-hour sessions out of Orange County, Relationship 180. Catherine is an amazing therapist. And let me tell you, it's changing my life, Michael, what it's doing.
Take your time.
Yeah, it's helping me pull that trauma I went through as a teen, and I have been stuffing that for decades and decades and reopening up that part of my heart and letting it go, saying, hey, the little boy in me is safe. Today, I am okay. I don't have to worry about where I'm at today. I'm healthy. I'm safe. But it's also allowing me to decompress all of those situations, circumstances that I went through. You know, at the age of 16 years old, I had my first kid. Michaela, it was my first kid. And, you know, here, a kid having kids with adult responsibility is truly not a great recipe for success. You literally have, and you throw an addiction into it and trying to hold a job and be like my dad and then everything else and then all the family members. So it was very, very difficult to really hold all this together. And then that amount of responsibility of having a child, oh gosh, it just spun me into a different world. And then, you know, trying to go to school and all of this different stuff, ended up getting expelled for having drugs at school. Currently, Michael, I have a 10th grade education. God has really aligned different areas of my life, you know, and I never did graduate, but he has blessed me with a business. And today I read books and different things, but we'll get a little bit into that a little bit later. But at the age of 18, I had my daughter, Alexis. At that time, I was living in Pomona. In Pomona, my uncle, I was helping him manufacture methamphetamine. Super not proud of it. He had a house. He did contracting. You know, he would basically take these houses and cut them from the inside, rebuild them. And then he would set up his labs and they're making pounds of meth every single week. And here as a 17-year-old kid doing and helping his uncle do this stuff, it's like, come on. When I turned 18, 19 years old, I had my daughter, Alexis, and I remember driving out to the Coachella Valley where I live, or where my wife or girlfriend lived at the time, and say, God placed on my heart, you know, surrender, give it up. I threw away everything that I had. And at that point, an intersection of my life had never kind of looked back for a while. And it was just like that surrender, that moment of saying, hey, I'm giving it up. And it was, there was clarity to it. I pushed in. I continued to try to build a foundation for my family, ended up getting a job, started to attend here and there different meetings and such forth. But I didn't have the fundamental basis of what manhood looked like. I didn't have the basis of what sobriety looks like or even the tools to stay sober.
Chris, you've made so many points in the last few minutes. I want to go back to, you know, as an adult, you know, 20, 30 years later, you're still dealing with the post-traumatic stress of what you went through as a young child. And I think it's important for people to realize, people think you go into like a drug treatment program in 6 weeks, you're healed.
No.
You come out. No, it doesn't happen like that. It takes 10 to 20 years to reverse and heal those wounds that you receive as a child. Because, you know, as a child, things get in, they sink in, and it's like a virus that just never leaves, right?
Yes.
So you've been dealing with this emotional, traumatic virus, this transgenerational transition of drug usage and bad parental guidance for years. And now you're dealing with it. It seems like you're coming out of it, but still you're in that pocket of healing.
Yes. Every day I have to wake up. And when I wake up, I say, Lord, you lead, I follow. Because Michael, I don't have it all together. You know, it's every day is a struggle, you know, and every day is a new venture. I strap on my shoes the same way you do. You know, I put on my pants the same way you do. But the difference is I have to realize Chris Schultz is an addict. And Chris Schultz is one decision away from picking up and using. And not to say that I am there today, because I have an amazing support team, but that is how I have to look at it with my accountability teams, my sponsor, my therapy, and most importantly, my men's groups. Men's groups, it's huge, because I could pick up the phone and I could call a brother. And I could say, hey, today I'm struggling. You know, I had a client yell at me, or even I have an issue with an employee not doing what they're supposed to. And, you know, I'm just struggling with this. And I just need somebody to dump on. But that's the support team us addicts, we need. One of the coolest things, when I ended up getting sober back in 2015, I joined Rotary. And Rotary was a part of my life. And our Rotary Club was here in Indio. And guess what? It was made up of judges, attorneys, DAs, police officers, and everywhere else. And I was getting sober, and I was literally 4 months, and I wanted to give back to the community. And I had another brother, Jeff Gonzalez, pastor. Now he's assemblyman here locally, really good friend of mine. He's the one that introduced me to it. And that accountability in that Rotary Club, because I was open, I'm an addict. And them to call and check in with me, to check in with them every single week, it helped me. It really did. I had friends that were my friends who genuinely cared, not just for me, but my family and my kids as well.
You know, Chris, when we look at the overall situation, you know, I read a lot of statistics, I keep up on what's happening. with teens and children. You know, we have more teens dying from drug usage. We have more young ladies out there in prostitution. We have more. We basically have the breakdown of the centralized nucleus of the family. And I think, you know, that part of that is due. We've moved away from church. We've moved away from our spirituality. And that battle that you're in, that's a spiritual battle.
Absolutely.
That's making your physical battle much more difficult. Do you think we as a society, you know, I'm just talking about the United States, do we need, when we talk about drug prevention and drug treatment, do we need to start looking at the root causes? Families that are in distress seems to be the starting point. We can get back and identify families in distress and work with those parents and work with those children. Maybe we can prevent the next Chris Schultz from taking 15 to 20 years to get better. But how do we do that? Now, you said you're working in the ministry. Are you involved in any programs working with broken families that have kids at risk and parents at risk for that matter?
Absolutely. No, and that's a good point. Let's look at our 30,000 foot level here. We have in our society these days is that we have teenagers or the youth that are living with grandma. They're living with grandpa. They're living with the foster parents. They're living with aunts, uncles, because, or even stepdad after stepdad after stepdad, stepmom after, et cetera. Okay. And now where is the core value of healthy boundaries? What does manhood and womanhood look like for these younger generations who are growing? And so I feel capturing them at a very young age, teaching them healthy boundaries, communication skills, also being assertive with feelings is very important, because kids these days, oh, you shouldn't feel that way. I was raised in a sense like you're a man, you don't cry because you're a man. But that's not true, because that means my feelings don't matter. And we want to allow the youth to make them known that, hey, you do matter. How you feel, I want to hear how you feel. I want to have compassion of what you're going through and what you're feeling here. And so through it, as we look at churches, and what I love about Celebrate Recovery is that broken families come in. And when a broken family comes in, you're having the same curriculum for the youth, which is going to be from the age of 5 until middle school. And that's called Celebration Place. And then you have the Landing, which is for your teenagers up till 18. And then you have Celebrate Recovery, which is the older generation, moms, dads, aunts, whatever it is, above 18. Now, they're learning the 8 principles, 12 steps, the Beatitudes of the Bible, scripture, and it's starting at a young age. It's growing. Lives are being changed. Generational sin is being distinguished at the feet of the cross. And what is happening, we're seeing more and more of this, is the courts can't say, hey, we want you to go to Celebrate Recovery because it is a biblical-based program. But that's the number one resource that the CPS, Child Protective Services, and even the other the courts are saying, hey, go to Celebrate Recovery. Because it's just not for you, it's for the family as well. You're gaining coping skills and learning skills to come together as a healthy family. I believe also in CPS, Child Protective Service. And Michael, myself, I had, this is how bad my addiction was. I literally had CPS in my life 36 different times. Out of 36 times, they could never, you know, I would manipulate the system and pee clean, or I was a smooth talker. I knew it. And all of this stuff started at a very young age. I learned how to manipulate and survive. That's the lifestyle that we want. We want to be healthy. We want to be good humans. We want integrity of what our words say. That's the meaning behind it.
Yeah. I mean, you said so many important things there, but really what catches me is that it took you years after being an adult to understand what it meant to be a man. You never, you know, of course, mothers are very important, but I just want to focus on fatherhood right now, because, you know, you're a man and this is what we're really talking about. But the father is such an important centralized figure, both to boys and girls, but especially to young boys in that developmental stage. That's who they look up to. That's who they emulate. And that's who they want to become. But you're having your first child at 16 and another child at 18. You're still very much a child yourself.
Yes.
Trying to raise children with no skills as a father. You know, and then you talk about the triggers, right? You say you're still an addict. Years later, even though you went to recovery in I think you said with 2015?
Yes, sir.
2015. That was a long time ago, but that right trauma trigger, you could be right back to square one. And that's where that support network comes in. And you mentioned the Rotary Club, you know, the men's group, the programs that you're in where you can pick up the phone and say, hey, I had a rough day. I need some help because I'm close to the edge. That is, people need to understand, if you don't have those support mechanisms, if you're just going through the system, Child Protective Services, and they're putting you back into the same negative environment that you came out of, that kid's going to relapse. The recidivism rates are so high now for drug treatment. You know, and I just read a report that there's more cocaine coming into the States. Cartels are selling more methamphetamine. There's more fentanyl out there. We are under a physical and a spiritual attack by the enemy, and he's crushing us right now.
Yes.
There are so many Chris Schultz out there being created every day, but we just need a larger program. Maybe the state has to just get involved and step across that line and say, we got to talk to Chris Schultz and see what he's doing because his program's working.
That's right. That'd be great. This is a great, Michael, check this out. Last night, men's group, we have a men's group. We're going, it's called Growing Healthy. We do family, intimacy, friendship, and temptation. Great study. I think I have a book here, but that's another subject. Kenny Luck is a man's man. Kenny Luck is a phenomenal writer, and he's a pastor, and he focuses on manhood and bringing the manhood up in Christ. And I've had the privilege of walking the journey with him for the past 3 years and literally him discipling me. And one of the cool things that we were able to do was we went and fed the seniors. Got a senior citizen complex. They don't have much money. So we ended up as the guys coming together and going there, providing Thanksgiving dinner for them. We were able to pray. They were so, so thankful. There was about 50 of them, and it was just super cool. Afterwards, a lady comes up, she speaks Spanish, buddy Jose, he was there, translates it and says, my son needs your help. Right afterwards, we four of us walked over to her house, and this guy was really literally contemplating suicide, divorce of his wife, went through rehab. We were able to like literally come side by side with him, talk to him, get a hold of the Coachella Valley Rescue Mission. And literally today he walked in the doors of CVRM and he's going to give his life, you know, 8 months in a biblical based program. And so those opportunities, Michael, are everywhere we go. It's that person who has been thinking about it and that angel that comes around and just speaks the light into them at that given time. And it was a divine appointment by God. And these, we get to experience these motions and these moments all the time. I'm going to tell you, I could tell you story after story that we've been able to have these cool divine appointments and watch God, not me, just me being willing and other people be willing, just pour into somebody else like somebody has poured into me.
Yeah, I think people have just forgotten our Judeo-Christian roots, right? That's where we used to come from. That I remember growing up, I was in church. My mom was a school teacher and a minister, and I was in church always on Sunday. But I think it was like Tuesdays and Thursdays also. I was like, "Geez, Mom, can we just have a normal life? We're living in church." But you know, I look back on it now. You know, I laugh. Like back then, it wasn't so fun as a 16-year-old sitting in Wednesday on a church service. But I look back and I look at the lessons learned from my mother and my father. And I think part of the reason where I am today is because I had that very strict, narrow Christian upbringing. You know, it worked for me. I'm not saying it's the answer for everybody, but certainly I think within the spectrum of what we're talking about, it's a potential answer for many people out there dealing with the problems that you had. Maybe it won't work for everybody, but certainly I think it can work for thousands of teens and families who are struggling with addiction and looking, how do I transition from the dark to the light?
That's right. So good. So good. And what I'll do, I like it, Michael, because our pastor grew up in the Midwest and country boy pastor, love him, Pastor Ricky. And he's like, I was drugged when I was a kid. I was drugged to church. I was drugged to Bible study. I was drugged to every spot, you know, and you think about it. But that sets a great foundation. Let's shift gears into the programs that the state does offer. Here in Riverside County, they offered, and one of the biggest tools for myself at that time was MHS. MHS is Mental Health Systems. What it does is I had back in 2013, a CPS worker show up, and I was, running, invading from them. And I said, okay, I'm going to meet with you. All right. And literally I met him at a hotel and sat down with him. And Marvin was the CPS worker's name. And he says, Mr. Schultz, this is your case file. They even brought it. It was big. And they're just like, we've never been able to really do much, with you. And you're a smart kid. And why don't you give us 18 months to 2 years to help you change, to give you a different lifestyle, and not just for you, but your kids. I can remember myself crying, literally had a bike, didn't have much. I was homeless, basically. And me looking up at him with tears just rolling down my face and saying, I will do it. I'm an addict. And that was the first time I could remember me saying, I am an addict and I need help. And they said, we'll be in contact with you. You could go back to your wife's house and we will be in touch. Literally the next day, I get a call and I go to court and I get put into a MHS class where they drug test you. But what it did, Michael, there was accountability, but I also learned healthy communication skills, parenting, communication skills with my actual wife at the time. And going through this program, what I ended up doing was letting go of my wife at the time. And your people are like, wow, why didn't you stay? You got healthy and everything else. But there was so much resentment and anger. I was wanting to get healthy, but she was wanting to stay in her denial, her dysfunction, her decisions. And I am not going to live with those issues. That is her circus, not mine. I had a lot of other stuff. So I ended up getting a place and CPS awarded me 50% custody of my kids and just continue to just press into program. Now, I did have a relapse for 3 months, but in that relapse, what I learned was this life is not for me. And I can remember, completely surrendering that and saying, you know what, this life it's not for me. And distinguishing it, I went to Celebrate Recovery out of Saddleback Church. It was a 3-day conference where it's a summit, like all people from all around the world come there and it's all ministry leaders. And it was come as you are, Michael, back in August 11th. 2015, I came how I was, broken, homeless, restraining order, all of this different stuff. And I literally had drugs. I could have got loaded the whole time. I really could have. And I said, God, you show me your way. And when I did so, he just took the edge away. I threw it all away and I've never looked back ever since. Now, it's those programs, MHS, mental health systems, that are there to help, but the individual has to be willing to say, hey, I'm in it for the long run. I'm in it for the long run.
And I think you just nailed the centralized point with MHS is you have to have people in there who are willing to make the hard decisions, right? You mentioned accountability, responsibility. And the hardest thing you had to do was look at your wife and say, it's not working. And I know so many couples who are in bad relationships and stay in those relationships because they don't want to leave. They don't have the strength to leave a partner who is negative, who is bringing them down. And then the kids suffer and the family sees that. Next thing you have this transition of bad behavior to the children. But I can't imagine how difficult that was for you to walk away from your adult spouse and say, I got to go alone because you're not helping me get better. You're bringing me back to that bad place.
Yes. And because I was the one with the addiction, it was always my issue. We live like this because of Chris, just so much denial, blame, and shame. And we were horrible to each other. But it was a decision, not just for myself. It was the decision that my kids would not have to witness the dysfunctional behavior, the screaming, the yelling, the arguing, the fighting amongst each other. I was done with it. I was done. And so, you know, she was very resentful, got a restraining order, lied about her stuff. But it was actually, in a sense, I think the judge, in a sense, that it happened. The reason why is because it kept me away. And what it did, it kept me working on me. If that makes sense. I knew my kids were safe. I knew because I just knew that they were. And now God has restored this relationship. I have full custody of my daughter, who is 12 years old, and she doesn't have to live that way. She doesn't have to be exposed to addiction. The judge gave me full custody on an extensive custody battle. You know, mom accused me of molesting my child, had to pay for all of these 730 evaluations and everything else. But even through that trial of life, that was hard, Michael, let me tell you, you know, because if a man in his recovery is being tested, imagine having that being accused. And, you know, the officer, when he came to my house, he says, you know, I'm thinking about filing a restraining order against your ex-wife. Hey, she is resentful, bitter, and it's just not right. Then praise God, the judges, everyone saw through it. You know, today I'll share a victory with you. I have a son, Nathan. Nathan is 25 years old. Nathan has been smoking weed, drinking ever since 14 years old, you know. And so you look at him, 11 years, this is his development of his brain. It's not there. His mentality, you know, and he's holds a job, has this great lifestyle. But Nathan, I met Adam for dinner about a month and a half ago. Pops, dad and Nathan went out to dinner, a nice restaurant. You know, I sat there. We ordered great food. I ordered an iced tea. You know, he ordered his drink and didn't say anything to him. Afterwards, we hugged. Love you, son. Very proud. A week later, he calls me. He says, Dad, I've been clean for a week. I have not been clean. And he says, I've been thinking about it, how much is ruining my life and how far you have come. That is God. That is doing the right thing, living right in recovery. That is making wise decisions because that is being witnessed from your children. Those decisions, those actions, that obedience, they are witnessing that without a word coming out of my mouth. And those actions are more, they send more visuals than anything else to them. And so it was like, and he said, thank you. And today he's been clean for 6 weeks almost.
You know, that's
good.
No, and you think, and literally Michael, he has not been clean ever since 14 years old. Yeah, maybe a couple of days, whatever it is, you get sick and, you know, but he's always smoked weed, vaped and drink, you know, and whatever the other drugs were at the time. But today, 6 weeks sober, my daughter, Alexis, you know, 27 years old. I was able, when I got clean, she came into my house. And I invited her in. I had about a year and a half clean, so sobriety. I invite her in. And she asked me, she says, Dad, will you take me to rehab and help me find a rehab? So I found a place out of a Laguna Niguel area, Dana Point. And, you know, she ends up getting clean. You know, she's going on 9 years of sobriety, almost. 9 years, Michael. So it's when we as the adults, or as the fathers and mothers decide to get sober and get right and get healthy, all the other people in our family do.
You know, it's interesting, during my monologue, I introduced you as a victim of intergenerational transmission of substance use addiction. Now you are a success story of intergenerational transmission of success, right? It is that role model, that mountain you climb to become this new man, this new father, most likely saved your son's life and your daughter's life. Because they could, if you were still in that old paradigm of using, your son would have been like, he would have never made it, I think. And your daughter would have never made it. But, you know, it took 15 years, but he got the message. And that's, it takes as long as it takes, right? And families need to understand, but you can never give up on your children. You have to just keep fighting and fighting until they see that light and they make that first. You can't make people do that. They have to hit bottom.
Yes.
And then realize, I can either go up or I can stay where I'm at. This is not a very good place.
That's right. Well said, Michael. I love it. Yes. Well said. Yeah.
You are definitely on a track of success. You know, I mean, I'm listening to your story. I've heard a lot of success stories, but yours really resonates with me because I haven't talked to many people in your situation who started out at such a young age. You know, one or two success stories out there, but by far the most people I've talked to did not make it that far, and their kids are deceased in drug use and incarcerated. But I think this is the message of success that I want our podcast viewers on The Matrix to listen to, because usually we're talking about the dark side of humanity, drug trafficking, criminality, opioid addiction, right? But we need to start talking about those success stories that come out of that dark world, because it is not the end. It is maybe the beginning of something new, like for you. Now tell me about your business. You started your own business.
Yes.
But you never graduated high school.
I know. Tell me about it.
I need to start my own business and I got a master's degree and I can't figure it out.
I've been working in the electrical industry for quite some time. I grew up. Dad was in the electrical industry. Uncle's family, it was like, they used to say, hey, we don't have veins, we have wires going on in us and stuff. So when I was sober in my 20s, you know, in and out, I used to do a lot of electrical contracting and, you know, not myself, working for different contractors. And through it all, when I first got sober, I started making pizza at a pizza factory with the elders of our church. They owned a pizza spot, and all of the youth used to work there from high school ministry. And I was getting involved in the high school ministry, just pouring into these young men, the stuff that they struggle with, porn addiction, identity issues, drugs. And I was able to just talk to them and encourage them. And it was just a cool spot. And God started to really rebuild Chris. And so he humbled me to a level of being more submissive to him. Like, I would have never thought making pizza. And then he continued to just to elevate me. Went to work with a HVAC company. I said, you know what? This was back in 2017. I excelled into that. And then I said, I want to get my electrical contracting license. And they're just like, we'll support you. Get it. And I ended up getting my electrical contracting license, opened up a division, and it just went, whoosh, blew up. And through it, back in 2020, my wife and I were praying, 2021-ish, hey, maybe we should open up our own business. And what I was doing, was modeling. Okay, I used to hire a lot of people from the Coachella Valley Rescue Mission, which is a rescue mission. They have a New Light program, and then they have a Gateway program. So people out of the New Light program, at a certain time, they could start working. So I'd hire these guys. They were on fire for the Lord. And these are all addicts, homelessness, traffickers, white collar crime, dark collar crime, whatever it is. You know, these dudes were like hard, you know, or even with the actual IROC program. What IROC is the individuals who are, this is their last chance before they go to prison for a very, very long time. Intensive 18 to 24 month program, work with probation, ABC club, you know, there's a lot of accountability with it. So we started to hire, you know, and I used to pick and choose. And then, you know what, we opened our own business. And my wife and I said, we're hiring people with second chances who deserve that second chance. Probation, my buddy Gabe, who runs the program over there, he's like, I got these really good guys. bring them in. We start hiring people, and the Lord just started to just blossom this, and he continued to just give us different businesses. We're right now building a 36,000 square foot rehab facility. It's called the ABC Club, dual diagnosis. So it does mental health and rehab, male and female, has gymnasium. That's just one project, prevailing wage. So, you know, our electricians are making, you know, 80 something bucks an hour. And we did Mama's House. Mama's House is amazing for trafficked women with children coming out of abusive relationship. We did their new campus, which was roughly around 15,000 square feet. Right here in the Coachella Valley. So the Lord gave us these jobs and said, here you go to get you started. And it's just amazing. It really is. And three quarters of our company are graduates from a New Life program. And they are the most loyal, the most honest. They're the most hardworking employees. They make the business. We don't. They're the ones, and we show gratitude and love to them. And they pay taxes, they pay their child support, they pay all of their restitution, all of this stuff. And they come in and you just see them smile. You come up with a, you know, hey Chris, my car broke down. My wife and I will pray. Hey, you know what? We got a buddy over here selling a nice little car. Let's get it for him. You know, and you should see the smile when you give an employee a car who's gone through program, who has about 3 years of sobriety, and nobody really gave them anything in life. And you do something like that, it changes their life. The tears and the gratitude and everything. It's such a blessing to be in a position to be able to give back like this.
You know, you're really talking about that. It reminds me of my Bible school days, the conversion of Paul, the apostle, right? The road to Damascus.
Yes.
Right? Meaning the sudden and radical conversion of thought or change of hearts and minds. And, you know, of course, this is in reference to the Christian context, but this sounds like your story, you know, that road of destruction. And suddenly you had this radical realization that there was another path. But your company is really interesting because, you know, for years the focus for teens was you got to go to college, you got to get a degree, and you have to get your master's degree. That was a lot of pressure, and a lot of kids couldn't make that jump, and they fell in the cracks. And then the trade schools or teaching trade in schools was taken away. But it sounds like, you know, what you're doing is bringing kids in who are at risk. I say teenagers or young adults who are at risk, and you're giving them that workable trade. You know, AI can never wire a house.
That's right.
Right? AI can do a lot of things, but they can't build buildings. They can't build homes. They can't lay, they can't do plumbing work, you know, et cetera. All the things that I can't do, basically. But what you're doing is giving people a practical skill that they can go out and make an honest living with. And that's a wonderful thing.
No, yeah, absolutely. So take, for instance, in the state of California, you have to be an ET, and that's an electrical trainee card. And so we offer WECA, which is an apprenticeship program. We have the Dr. Carrion Foundation that we partner with, and the Dr. Carrion Foundation will pay for half of their education, and Dr. Carrion will pay for the other half. So they get books, and what it does, it's a four-year program. You have module 1 through 4. Module 1 is, you know, broken out into quarters, or it's self-paced. If they learn quickly, man, they could blow right through it and be done with module 1 the first year within a couple months. So we pay for that education. And at the end of the 4 years, we, meaning our company and Dr. Carrion Foundation, after 4 years, they could go and take their journeyman electrician exam. Now, we're not just helping them stay clean and guiding them into that direction and just making day in and day out wise decisions. No, we're equipping them with their education so they have a career so that they could live sustainably. If they leave here and decide to go to Colorado and work, they could walk in. I'm a journeyman electrician. I'm an ET. I've been in the trade for X, Y, and Z years. here's a reference. There you go. Buy them tools, equip them so that their confidence boosts above and beyond that they have everything that they need to provide for themselves.
You know, Chris, we need to get you some federal grants because, you know, the main problem with many drug rehabilitation programs is they're not coupled with job training, right? They just send people back to the same broken environment where they fall back into recidivism.
Yes.
But if we were to build a national program using your model, right, not only are we're going to talk to you, we're going to give you counseling, we're going to get you to a good place, but we're going to train you how to take care of yourself, how to be an adult man or woman, how to take care of your family and make a decent living, well, I think we would see the numbers just skyrocket. Are you looking at grants or trying to expand your program at a federal level?
You know, that would be awesome. You know, I look at it, Michael, one step at a time. And what I continue to find, the course and the path that comes across each and every day is God is continuing to put different opportunities in our path. I will share this. And this is a huge prayers report for me because I owed $130,000 in child support. At one point, it was almost $200,000. That's kind of the man. I didn't pay my responsibilities. You know, a lot of it was arrears. On Monday, by the grace of God and His love, I was able to pay that off.
That's amazing.
And those are the one day at a time steps that I'm continuing to do. Yeah, majority was arrears. But you know what? I said, you know, my wife and I prayed and we just said, let's do it. And we were able to do it. And I look at it as more of these projects come through. I'm going to tell you, Michael, I don't think being a electrical business owner is my calling. I'm just going to be real. I really think my calling is to love people and show them the God's love, the agape love and compassion in His grace is ministry.
Yeah. But this is your tool, though. This is your tool, Chris.
But it is my connector.
Connector, yes.
It is the connector or raceway to touch the lives.
Absolutely.
And He will provide that ministry for me if I just stay focused. Like the Dr. Kerryon Grant just came across, you know. I said, wow, that's great. You know what? The guys on their graduation, we had a guy who never graduated high school. Gangster. To the fullest, has NDO tattooed on his head, has, oh, I'm going to tell you, tattoos, did jail time, ran yards. And this guy, you should have seen him when he got his grant and he went up to the top, he glowed. And we're not just talking him. That was 9 of our employees. Praise God.
But you know, Chris, I wouldn't be doing a fair service to you if I didn't ask you to tell me about your wife. Apparently you got remarried.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk about, you know, how powerful your spouse is and how she's helped you maintain this course.
Oh, yes. Okay. So she was definitely handpicked. We're polar opposites. My wife was raised in the Air Force. She didn't do the Air Force, but her father was very, very high up in the Air Force, military background raising. So everything is order, fight or flight. You can't leave out the dishes or the house may blow up kind of deal.
Right.
The bed is made, like everything is picked up. So she's order. I'm completely opposite. My wife was married to a Riverside County sheriff. They divorced. My wife's sister was a Chicago highest ranking police officer for gang task force. Just everybody in the family is law enforcement. Praise God. And God said, you need her. So through it all, she brings a lot of complimentary into our marriage. She brings a lot of order, which I didn't have as a raising. I get frustrated. We get frustrated with each other. That's why we're in marriage therapy every week. But it builds our marriage. She's also a Rotarian. She's a ministry leader for our church. We met at church in auditorium number 2. Her daughter, Taryn, my stepdaughter, which I love her kids. So we have a total of 11 together, no child together though, you know, so she has 3, I have 8. And her daughter, Taryn, knew Sophia and all my kids, you know, since 2013. her daughter was on staff, and yeah, she knew my kids. I knew Taryn, her daughter, before her mom. And Jennifer and I were business partners. You know, we work together, live together, boat together, ministry together. We do a lot of together stuff. I will say I love her. I love her love for our kids.
No, that's powerful. You know, and it just goes to show that that solid family unit that you've rebuilt is a success, is a great model for parenting, for bringing kids out of distress and moving forward. But Chris, we only have a few minutes left. Is there an email or a phone number? When our guests here, when people tune into this, I have no doubt you're going to get calls from some parents, families in distress, maybe some even some investors who want to say, man, I listened to that podcast, Chris, and I got to help you move this program forward. Is there a phone number or an email people can reach out to you if they so feel the desire to?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll give you my personal cell phone. I would request that you text me, letting me know the podcast, because a lot of the times I get spam calls and everything else. I want to respect everybody, and everybody has a voice, and I want it to be heard. So my cell phone is 760-600-0799. And also, like I said, please text, let me know. I will give you a phone call back. Email is chris@schultzenterprises.com. That's chris@schultzenterprises.com.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you again, just for my audience. I want to let them know this is an amazing guest. We had an amazing conversation. This is Chris Schultz, the intergenerational transmission of success, no longer a failure. But please, I encourage parents who are struggling with addiction, who have children struggling with addiction, to reach out to Chris to say, hey, Chris, I heard you on the Opioid Matrix with Mike Brown. I'm in crisis. I need to talk to you. Or, hey, I'm an investor. I love what you're doing with the young adults, getting them a trade, getting them addiction treatment, and making them a success. So, Chris, again, I want to thank you for coming on The Matrix. This was a great episode. I want to have you back so we can continue the conversation and see where you are in a few months from now.
Perfect. Sounds good, Mike. Thank you for having me.
All right, Chris. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Stay well, friend.
Thank you for joining host Michael Brown for this episode of The Opioid Matrix, A Journey into the Rabbit Hole, a Rugaku podcast. Keep connected with us by subscribing to the show on your favorite podcast player. If you like what you've heard, please rate the show. No matter the controversy around the illegal drug supply chain, our mission is to save lives. Thanks for listening. Until next time.